I'd like to start actually going from, you went to art school.
I did.
I was curious how going to art school led to the music you're working on now, or if there was some kind of parallel activity you could talk about.
Good question. I've been playing music longer. Well, that's not true. I mean, I got in trouble all through grade school for drawing instead of paying attention in class. And, you know, I've been playing music. I started playing the sax in grade school at age 9. I wanted to play the trumpet. They didn't have any. So they gave me an alto sax. And within 2 or 3 months, I played an a cappella version of Franz Liszt's Liebestraum at the Bardonia Elementary Christmas pageant. But then, by the time I got to 7th grade, it just, the academic, sitting in the orchestra or the band, just wasn't working. And I found myself like getting kicked out, much to my mother's dismay, 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade. I just, you know, and I'm trying to play Tchaikovsky's 4th Symphony like Albert Eiler before I'd ever heard who Albert Eiler was.
That would be an amazing recording.
But, you know, to answer your question, it's a difficult question because, you know, so I went to art school. Didn't know what I wanted to do, but a teacher, I took a drawing class because my grades were going. And so I took a drawing class, and the teacher, who just happened to be a good friend of the sculptor, David Smith, said, "Dietrich, your work's damn near professional. You ever think about having a career in the arts?" Probably the worst advice anybody could have given me. And so I worked my ass off over the summer and produced a portfolio to bring to various art schools, and I was accepted at Pratt and Parsons, and of course I told my parents I want to be an artist, and my father said I'm not paying for art school. He wanted me to get a job in the post office. Of course I had no money to pay for this, so when I was interviewed at Parsons, they said, "Good news, you're in." I said, "Not so much," because I was accepted at Pratt with advanced standing, which was a lie, because I had no money to pay for college. So I basically had a 4-year degree in 3 years. It was my first sales job. And I'm sorry, I digress. I almost don't even remember what the question is at this point.
I was just wondering how your time, if possibly your time in art school had effect on your music or not.
Well, you know what? That really is a good question, because one of my sculpture professors was a wonderful man who's since passed on, named Brad Graves, who's also played alto sax, and his wife Verna Gillis ran Soundscape.
Oh, okay.
And so the exposure to all of this music that Brad, it was just amazing. You know, going to Soundscape all the time and seeing all the, especially the European improvisers.
Could you mention some names from the people that you saw during that period?
Not only saw, but ultimately played with. I mean, one of the greatest concerts I've ever seen to date was Peter Kowal, bass player. To this day, I would say it's quite possibly the greatest concert I'd ever seen, and it was the audience consisted of Donald Miller, Don Dietrich, Jim Sorter, Borbino Magus, and whomever their respective girlfriends were at the time, and that was the audience. And he played for like 45 minutes of some of the most inspired music I'd ever heard.
A solo bass concert.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. Just remarkable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, Brad Graves exposing me to a lot of this music was really important. And then, of course, you know, I mean, that was in the mid-70s. And then in 79, hooking up with Donald Miller, who also had a vast knowledge of contemporary classical music. You know, I grew up in a really conservative, white bread suburb of the city, Manhattan. And, you know, you get some Beefheart and some Zappa, but there was no jazz of any consequence. Mm-hmm. So having exposure to this stuff was really, really important. But then, you know, hooking up with Donald Miller and then, you know, hearing about, you know, Xenakis and Stockhaus and Ligeti and all these contemporary classical people was pretty amazing to me.
And when did you start exploring, like, the overtones on the saxophone using electronics and pedals? When was that brought in?
Well, Jim Sauter and I were playing with a technique that we call bells together, where we lock the bells of the horns, saxophones together with microphones dropped in with, you know, large amplification, even before 1979 when we met Donald Miller. So we were doing that in 76. Wow. And the effects pedals came into play. You know, I was a rock guitar guy. You know, I started playing sax at 9, but at 10 there was the Beatles, right? So I wanted to play the guitar. So I learned to play guitar, and I was actually in a rock band as a lead guitarist for, you know, until the early 70s, playing, like, forgive me, Mahavishnu covers. And so I was familiar with effects pedals. And interestingly, it was a bass player who's, again, deceased, Adam Nodelman, at one of our concerts. He was playing with echo box or something like that. And he hooked it up to a microphone, threw it down Jim Sauter's bell, and it was like, ding, that's it. So effects pedals. And that would have been, I don't know, mid-80s.
Wow. And how did you get the idea to do the bells together thing and drive the saxophones through the amplifiers?
I think I was about 14 or 15 years old, and all of those same things that were getting me kicked out of band, it was all part of Bells Together, because, I mean, it was like, wow, that sounds really fucked up. I mean, how great is that? Ouch.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your other work with the sculpture, because there's some connections, I think. When you Don came out to play in September of last year, and there was a horrible rainstorm. I think it was the first concert we ever had to cancel in the Option Series. But we got to hang out, a bunch of us, with him with dinner, and he talked a little bit about his sculpture. I didn't know anything about that. And there's some relationships, I think you talked about physicality and whatnot. But maybe we could look at some of the pieces and you could talk about them a little
absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely.
You want to talk about this one?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can speak in generalities. So the material is polycarbonate. And a dear friend of mine, Mark Brescher, owns a factory in West Nyack, 5 minutes from where I live, called Plastic Craft. And he graciously has been allowing me to use his factory to make these sculptures, and his shop foreman, Young Nugent, basically makes sure that when I'm doing these, I don't cause bodily harm to myself, because, you know, it's a walk-in oven, and this is the material is polycarbonate, and it's industrial refuse. It's not it's Castaway stuff that Young keeps because he knows what I want. Mm-hmm. And so when we have time to go into the shop, it's really interesting because we hang these strips and pieces and whatnot from sort of rollers that go into this walk-in oven. And when the material gets just to the point where it's malleable, we pull it out, and I have at best 90 seconds to improvise a sculpture. And it's, you know, it's very similar to improvising a solo or a piece of music because, you know, it has to be, in this case, the material dictates the spontaneity of the process. And, you know, because it's quick, boom, 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 you don't have time to do a lot of editing or any editing. And I think it suits my temperament to a large degree in terms of my love affair with improvised art and music.
I've got a real quick question. You studied at art school, and as I overheard, it was more you had painting courses and whatnot. How did you get to working with sculpture?
Well,
and get to working with this kind of material?
Well, actually, I was 50% of the first graduating class of sculptors at Parsons.
Oh, wow.
There was me and another guy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And when I was going to the school, my work at that point was boulders and steel. And in fact, I still have some on my yard. And then another sculptor told me that he said that the best rust inhibitor for steel was used crankcase oil.
Okay.
And so I went to my mechanic and I said, I want an oil change and I want the oil that you drain out of my crankcase. So I took it home and I slathered it all over the sculpture I was working on. And I discovered that when the in the crevices, the pieces between the two pieces of steel, this crankcase oil would pool up and it was black like a mirror. And so I did that for a few years, and I started making sculptures that were like, I don't know how to describe this. They were sort of like a human circulatory system where you had a container that had this mirror-like black oil that also preserved the steel that it was in. Mm. But then there were sort of strange optical things where if you took a long steel sluice and it was arced a little bit, it looked like the oil was bending and not the steel.
Oh, okay.
In any case, but the bigger problem with that is you couldn't make them vertical because oil doesn't do that. And so then I discovered roofing tar, and I spent 30 years working with roofing tar. And
do you have any of those in the...
No, there are no roofing tar pieces, but you might find them on some Borbito Magus records. And so, and then my fishing buddy, Mark, invited me into his factory, and I found this wonderful material, which is very much like three-dimensional roofing tar. All of which, and this is really, boom. I mean, it's like as close to what you heard tonight, visually, as I think you could possibly get.
Said, I guess to connect to the music we heard today, how do you think about shaping a solo set like that? Because as I was listening, I mean, it definitely feels like there's a physicality, no question, but there's also organization going on. There's like concrete things happening within that physicality. How do you think about shaping the sound?
I don't.
You don't at all?
I mean, it's spontaneous. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, there are fortuitous accidents, and mm-hmm. and I look for those in my art and music, because there are things that fate just throws at you that you're not expecting. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that accident in itself is art, mm-hmm. and you don't have to do anything with it. It just happened. Other times it's a struggle. Tonight was not a struggle so much, you know, it was physically daunting, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you have to deal with it. I learned to deal with it spontaneously, mm-hmm. as do you, mm-hmm. as a player. Mm-hmm. You know, you're thrown into the situation, and you just have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. What I like is with all of these effects pedals. And yes, I've been using this same configuration for decades at this point. But even with that, there's some things that happen that are unexpected. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, that's nice. Let's just keep that going. Right, so
you're kind of setting something in motion, and then see where it leads you.
Exactly right.
With
yeah, I mean, and so, and it's like that with a sculpture, except that these sculptures, you know, unlike a set of music that extends for 45 minutes, these things have to be done in mm-hmm. like about 90 seconds.
But you also learn as you've done the process, like what certain things might drive towards or whatever.
You would think so.
But no.
No. Oh, okay. No. I wish that were the case. I mean,
so
it's
you're
like
really just jumping in and seeing other, what happens.
Not long ago, we had the oven cranked up to 464 degrees. And it was, we just wanted to see what would happen. And what happened was I got a sunburn. And the work wasn't that good.
And what, just out of curiosity, I mean, how are you dealing with the material if it's that hot? I mean, what are you wearing?
Welding gloves.
Welding gloves?
Yeah.
And just regular clothes?
Just.
And then you just, and that's it?
That's it.
And how big are these pieces?
That's a portrait of Donald Miller, guitarist of Bourbon and Magus. That became a portrait of him after it was finished. But that piece is actually about head size.
Okay.
And the way that was done is I took material and I threw it in a box and with newspaper and I set it on fire.
Oh, okay.
That was outside of the factory.
Okay, so you do that as a separate thing.
This, which is super nice, that's called This Leathery Awareness. Again, what I had was, you know, we had made that upright piece earlier in the session, cast it aside, mm-hmm. and then we took these other pieces, and then I put that into the oven with those, with the upright piece with those other ones. So, again, you know, it's...
And how big is that? Around the same size? Or
this big.
Okay. And I'm assuming that it's pretty toxic. Like working with this?
I sure hope not.
Okay. you haven't been tasting it or anything like that.
Thank you.
You worked with a band, a Swiss group called Voice Crack. They're a very important electronics group with Norbert Moslang and Andy Gould. And I don't know anything about them other than the music and the recordings. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about working with them and how they go about working.
Well, super nice guys. An early champion of Borbid and Magus, Hank Berkman, was in a sort of a international record sharing club. And so he would, you know, the concept, as I recall, because this goes back a very long way, but my recollection is this idea is like, if you found a record, you would buy multiple copies and you'd send it to all the folks in the club. And they would do that. They would reciprocate. You know, you found something really good, you'd buy enough copies to give everyone in your group.
Wow.
And so, so Andy and Norbert had a record on FMP. I think it was called Deep Voices.
Mm-hmm.
And Hank turned us on to them. And so, in his letter writing to Europe, got Borbid and Magus our first tour of Europe in 1984, and Norbert and Andy were kind enough to organize a concert in St. Gallen, Switzerland, and it was they played duo and we played trio, and then we played together, and we developed an immediate friendship, and you know, it was, if for those of you who don't know Voice Crack, you may know Giorgio Gomelsky, who produced a lot of Rolling Stone records and Yardbirds and Extrapolation by John McLaughlin, blah, blah, blah. And so we, Jim Sauter and I, organized a festival in Piermont, New York in 1985, 6, and 7. But in 85, Voice Crack were touring the States, so we had them, they came and played. And so they have these tables of these homemade electronic instruments, and they activate these little sound sculptures with light sensing doodads, so you could like shine a flashlight on them, that would turn that on. So this, you know, each musician had this table of all these various electronic things, and one of the things that was amazing is Giorgio Gomelsky was in the audience, and at one point they were playing apples with slivers of copper, and they transform apples into batteries.
Oh, wow.
And they're playing green apples, and I remember Giorgio was like,
it's a pretty good response, I think, at the time, probably. But have you worked with them since?
No.
Or, no, that was
no, it's been, a, it's been, you know what, they had a falling out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Norbert played with us at the Tusk Festival.
Mm.
And so for any of you who care, there's this movie made by a filmmaker named Jeff Mertens, a Borbido documentary, which is really pretty cool. It's, for me, it's kind of like watching 30 years of your life flash by in an hour. But there is some really pretty cool footage of both Voice Crack and our collaboration at the Tusk Festival with T. Makawa from Incapacitance and Jojo from Jojo Hiroshiga. So, anyway, but aside from that, not so much.
Okay. All right. There's a lot of... One last question. The New Monuments group, you know, Borbid and Magus goes back decades, and New Monuments is a more recent band.
True.
How did that come together, and how do you like playing with Ben and Spencer?
I love playing with both of them. February of 2008, I got an invitation from David Keenan to be in a 6 or 7-piece group in Glasgow, the Eureka Festival. Mm. And I said, yeah, I had nothing to do, so I flew to Glasgow. And Ben was one of the, I mean, David picked the musicians, Alan Silva, probably most noteworthy. And we spent a day at the Glasgow Art Museum, me and Alan, that was pretty cool. But I didn't know who Ben was, and so met him, liked him, mm-hmm. right off the bat, mm-hmm. and David Keenan wanted to do a trio at that point of him playing alto, me playing tenor, and Ben playing drums, kind of a Bobby Music mm-hmm. Cover band.
Oh, okay.
For those of you who may not know what Bobby Music is, it's a great Milford Graves record with two saxophones. Anyway, Keenan couldn't make the gig. Ben got Spencer, and we toured, and it was fantastic.
I have a question. Before your concert tonight, you mentioned that the great painter Larry Rivers was one of your teachers.
He was,
in art school. If I'm right about this, he was also a jazz musician.
Yes, he played. He played saxophone. In fact, he played on a. They produced a record, the 13th Street All Stars or something. It was. He played tenor. David Levy, who was the dean of Parsons, who went on to be the president of the Corcoran Gallery, and Howie Kanovitz played trombone, and I forget who else was. But that's true. He was my first painting teacher at Parsons.
Did you guys ever talk about music?
Never, not at all.
And visual art?
Because, you know what, at that point in my life, it was... I was still playing rock guitar, and I was not, I mean, I picked up the sax in 70, I picked up the sax again in 75 or 76 with real fervor after hearing, you know, Shep, and Eiler, absolutely, most importantly, the defining thing in turning my head around to what I wanted to do was hearing a Cecil Taylor record called Silent Tongues, solo Cecil Taylor record that had like hash stains all over it from the guy who gave it to me, who was cleaning his pipe. And I still have that record, and I still love it. It really changed, I think, the way I looked at a lot of things, like music and art and relationships. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I am necessarily right in where I'm coming from, but that record was so transformative to me. It's like everything just sort of came into focus. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what I mean, yeah.
You know, one of those, you know, solo piano things where it was like, I think I can do that. And so here we are.
Yeah.
So, speaking of records, you guys put out your own records.
Yes, that's true.
And thinking about this kind of touring network that you're describing for record sharing, letter writing, and the things where you're kind of setting up or able to take this music to Europe to play this and that, you decided to put out your own records. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that decision.
Well, the first Borbito record came out in 1980. And we went into, I mean, we'd been playing for about a year. Yeah, I'll go back to when we met. I mean, there's a wonderful radio station called WKCR in New York, 89.9 FM. And I'd been listening, I still listen. In fact, I just made a contribution to their fundraising yesterday.
Thank you.
And I'd been listening, Brad Graves, going back to Brad again, who turned me on, because I was listening to BGO, which was a dreadful jazz station. He said, no, you got to listen to KCR. And so that was remarkably important. And so as I'm listening to this, Friday afternoons from 3 to 6, all of a sudden I'm listening to things that are like, this is really interesting. I mean, imagine listening to Topography of the Lungs on one turntable with Metal Machine Music simultaneously on another turntable. And this is Donald Miller's radio show, right? And so it was remarkable listening, I mean, playing Lacey and all this great stuff. And so we called the station, said, listen, really like what you're playing. And Donald said, well, I play guitar. And Jim said, well, Don and I play sax. Don said, you want to come down and jam? So we did. And it was magic immediately. So we spent the next year or so woodshedding, you know, because it was easy to play in New York. There was lots of crappy, divey places that would, you know, and we're talking 79, right? So like really shitty places that you could play, and we played like every 2 weeks with a different name because we couldn't decide what name we wanted. So we went in, by 1980 we decided our craft was honed well enough that we should at least document this. So in Pomona, New York is a Unitarian church, and in the church is a recording studio, or at least was, called Skunk Hollow Recording Studio. True. And so we went in and in a day just recorded an album's worth of stuff, and we released 400 copies. And then when the boxes showed, it was like, holy shit, what are we going to do with these? And so, you know, they actually sold. Oh, there were a lot of people that said, you know, I was working a pretty crappy job and I'm hawking these records, and people bought them because they liked me, but then they said, there's something wrong with this record. I was like, well, actually, no. Does that answer your question?
Not really, but that was a great story.
Well, what motivated you to put out more records independently? Rather than try to get a label.
Well, there was no one else that would put them out, for one. And number two, I mean, it's like, well, you know, we took the proceeds from the sale of the first record and we rolled it into the second, into the third, and so forth. Mm-hmm. You know, and you get, you know, you have to be sort of financially clever with these things. There was a presenting organization at the time called Meet the Composer. And you know, we tapped into that, and you know, you'd have to learn. You had to know how to work the system, and you had to propose. You know, the following composer will, you know, present a new work for, you know, saxophone and prepared guitar and blah 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 blah. And then you sit back and wait, and then a month later, maybe they'd say you've been approved for a grant for $300. So we play a concert, and we take that $300 and put it into the slush fund to release more records. And we did that for quite a long time. And basically, that there's no secret. I mean, that's just the way it was. And this way, we got to release what we wanted to release, the cover art that we wanted to have. And
yeah, you had creative control.
Yeah, exactly right.